Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is all of it. Before Oprah, before Arsenio Hall, before Tom Joyner or Joy Reid, there was Ellis Haslip. In the 1960s, Haslip was the executive producer and host of the groundbreaking current events show Soul. He's the subject of a documentary called Mr. Soul, which is now screening virtually through September 24th via more than 90 online theaters. When the TV show Soul debuted in 1968, it was originally a local New York program. A year later, the series went national on PBS, produced by WNAT Channel 13. Soul was more than just a talk show. It was a political platform featuring African-American poets, artists, politicians, and activists at a time when Black Americans were asserting their civil rights unapologetically. The documentary Mr. Soul was written and produced by Sam Pollard and Melissa Haslip, who is also Ellis Haslip's niece. Ellis Haslip also happened to be a friend of my mom's in high school. I spoke with Melissa Haslip on WNYC in 2018 when Mr. Soul premiered at the 2018 Tribeca Film Festival. I began by asking Melissa what made her decide that her uncle's life should be the subject of a documentary.
You know, I just thought that this was such an incredible story that needed to be told. I felt that it was an era of time of great tumult and change, and yet nobody was really talking about the beginning of things, the beginning of freedom of expression, the beginning of redefining Black culture, the beginning of a reassertion and somewhat of a rebirth of Black culture as defined by Black people themselves. And I thought, nobody's really taken that point of view and told that story. And I thought, it's time. It's definitely time.
What was the mission of the show? What was Ellis's vision?
I think Ellis wanted to really be able to reflect true Black culture for the first time and bring it into people's living rooms. You know, there was such a divide at the time, 1968, especially after Martin Luther King had been assassinated. Every person who was of color was being defined by the outside and not by the inside. They didn't have an opportunity to show who they really were and to show that they were more than, you know, what do you see on television? You see riots, you see garbage not being picked up in Harlem. You know, that's not really what's happening. There's a renaissance out there. There's a way to express yourself that you haven't had an opportunity to do. And I think that was his vision.
One of the things you do in the beginning of the film, which is very helpful, is you provide context of what TV looked like at that time and what the Kerner Commission found. Explain a little bit about why you decided to set up the documentary that way. We don't learn about Ellis immediately. We learn about TV.
I think it's very important because it was the birth of public television and the Public Broadcasting Act is really inextricable when you're talking about the story of Soul reaching a wider audience and creating a Black audience, which had heretofore had not really happened. And so we thought it's really better if we can set up the zeitgeist of what was happening. What did Soul interrupt? What were we used to seeing on television? What were the models we knew? We knew The Tonight Show, we knew Ed Sullivan, but there really was no model for a show that was not only a vehicle for African-American artistry, but a platform for political expression and the fight for social justice. That's a trifecta that we hadn't seen yet. So I thought it would be really important to understand why that was unique for the time and why it really was revolutionary for television, especially public television.
You had a professor in the film, Sarah Lewis from Harvard, who said the media had been weaponized to argue for the inhumanity of African-Americans at the time.
Absolutely. And we love Sarah Lewis. She's so wonderful. And she had that book. She guest edited the Aperture, beautiful edition of Aperture Photography Magazine. And Sarah really speaks directly to the time that media had been weaponized because what was being shown on television was very specific to convey a sense of less than, of barbarity, of inequality. And that was the theme that was being pushed. And Ellis Haslip said, no, that's not who we are. There's so much more depth. There's so much more complexity. And all you need to do is see us. We're not here to entertain you necessarily. But if you're entertained and you learn something in the process, That's really wonderful.
When they came to him initially, they kind of described it as a Black Tonight show, and he said, no, that's not what I'm going to do. And he was very adamant about the content being undiluted.
Yes.
What does that mean?
Unfiltered, I would say. Mm-hmm. Sort of an uncompromising celebration of Black excellence, which really hadn't had an opportunity to be seen. Mm-hmm. The complexities of politics, of poetry, literature, and music, the Black arts movement was all about that, redefining really what it meant to be Black in America, what it meant to be Black on this planet.
Can you just go through a list of some of the guests he had? It's amazing when you start to think about it.
Oh my goodness. It was a bevy of African-American icons of the 20th century. We know now, of course, but many of them were receiving their first opportunity to be on television, such as, believe it or not, Earth, Wind & Fire for the first time, Al Green for the first time, Roberta Flack, Cicely Tyson, The Last Poets. Oh my goodness. There were just so many people that you would just die to see for the first time on television.
And then
it's
also
remarkable.
Iconic folks, Muhammad Ali, Sidney Poitier, Harry Belafonte, who's also in the film.
Yes.
Sort of as a witness to Ellis in the show.
He is an anchor for us because mm-hmm. he was there and he really speaks to the diversity of voices and the rich voices of the time speaking for Black culture.
Who do you think would have been a guest on the show today?
I think about that all the time. And we had the great opportunity to interview Questlove at The Tonight Show. He had just finished taping a show, and he allowed us to squeeze into the green room. And I thought, this is a person who is the legacy of soul. Mm-hmm. You know, here he is. Not only is he an exquisite sort of ethnomusicologist, he's a band leader. He understands the landscape of late-night television and the struggle of being an artist and also a representative of the culture. And what shocked me was to learn that he had an encyclopedic memory of the show and how the show had impacted his band and how he modeled sets that they did based on what he saw for the Roots, rather, the sets mm-hmm. they were doing for the Roots, for what he saw on Soul. And one particular example, we had to go in and recut the film because he talked about this moment when Earth, Wind & Fire played about 32 counts of eight, but they weren't playing anything. They were miming it. And the audience went nuts. And he said, we did that on our show. We based our show
wow.
on that. I think he would be the perfect host, if not the perfect guest, because he's a combination of all of these various art forms, and he doesn't limit himself.
Yeah,
Ellis didn't limit himself either.
I was thinking Kendrick Lamar would be, and you know, we really haven't seen a sit down with Colin Kaepernick.
That's true.
That would have been a soul guest.
Absolutely. The Rebels were welcome, and I think in every fiber of his being, Ellis believed in liberation as redefining culture based on liberation and freedom.
We're talking with Melissa Hayslip about her new documentary, Mr. Soul, about Ellis Hayslip, who is a groundbreaking African-American talk show host. Let's talk about his background a little bit. He was in TV, but he was sort of a bon vivant around New York City. What had he been doing before he was the television host?
Before he was a television host, he was steeped in the world of theater. He had worked with Vinette Carroll at the Urban Arts Corps and the National the Negro Ensemble Company, I beg your pardon. Mm-hmm. He had done a lot of theater. He had worked with Cicely Tyson, had produced shows up at the Harlem YMCA, had gone across Europe. He had met and worked with James Baldwin to produce the very first international tour of the Amen Corner in 1965. So he was really well-versed in theater, but he had his finger on the pulse of what was important and wanted to show all aspects of the arts and give a platform to women especially. That was really very important.
Yeah, his staff was also a lot of women, right?
A lot of women. Started out with Anna Maria Horsford was a temp at WNET, and he said, no, I think you'd make a great actress, and brought her on to be the associate producer of the show. And he was always putting women in front. He would have iconic poets interviewing iconic literary icons, well, that's redundant, but iconic icons. So he flew Nikki Giovanni, for example, to London to meet up with James Baldwin, who was living in exile, of course, mm-hmm. in St. Paul de Vence, and who didn't want to come back to America. He said, I'll meet you halfway. And they did this epic two-hour interview in London in 1971. It was just remarkable, and they turned it into a book.
He's not from D.C. I mean, he's not from New York. He is from Washington, D.C., and
yes.
He grew up in segregated Washington, D.C., and you touched on his desire to bring Black excellence, and this is where our paths cross, because
okay.
my mother went to high school with.
That's right.
With, he used to call him she called him Old Crazy Alice. Because at the time, you know, he was considered in high school a race man. He wanted to, that's what they used to call it back in the 40s, right?
But it's a positive term, actually. Yes. It comes from the idea of doing something great for the race. And since the race was segregated, to be able to push forward the agenda for the race and to better the race. And so not to be confused with being racist, but to be doing something for the race. So race movies or black westerns, they were all to give opportunities where there hadn't been before. And so at Howard University and also at Dunbar High School, these were his formative years. And one would think that having a segregated society to be lived in would be limiting, but it was actually the opposite. So he found solace and comfort and found his greatest exposure to theatricality was in the church. Mm-hmm. And so later on, he included a lot of gospel and music, and he produced the record Truth Is On Its Way with Nikki Giovanni, which in our film, Nikki talks about performing with the New York Community Choir and how important that was to her. And trying to incorporate all of these elements, it was really very special.
He was also openly gay.
Yes.
Even though his father was deeply religious, he was in that era of Bayard Rustin. That was brave at the moment.
Very, very brave. And we often wonder, how did he navigate those worlds to be openly gay and to live in that truth and to give everyone opportunities, especially people of color who would have been marginalized at the time, even by their families or their own communities, and by just the nature of, you know, you're on the tail end of civil rights, the heels of civil rights movement. There's enough to hold you down. Mm-hmm. But to have to limit yourself, he never saw that as a limitation, and he never, he just was really, it was really important to give people opportunities. And I think that's one of the most beautiful things about him is that he was always true to himself. And the fact that he was gay and promoting LGBT rights and openly challenging mm-hmm. people. Like, for example, there's this amazing episode where he openly challenges Minister Louis Farrakhan, who was quite a character in that time. And he's, you know, brings up the issue of many people found their righteousness while incarcerated in prison. And it's known that people who had same-sex relationships and same-gender loving, would they be accepted by the Nation of Islam? And he takes Farrakhan to task, mm-hmm. which was remarkable. Because on the one hand, he was promoting the opportunity for Farrakhan to speak, but on the other hand, he was challenging him, saying, you know, I see you,
yeah,
and you see me, but we're both going to openly have a dialogue here because that's what it's all about. We're going to give everybody a platform.
He did not shy away from controversy. He had Eldred Cleaver's wife on. He had Muhammad Ali at the height of his being against the Vietnam War. Do you think a show like this could exist now? I mean, it was radical. He had the last poets dropping the N-word, doing their word poetry. It was kind of, my jaw dropped a couple of times. I thought, wow, this was on TV?
It was pretty radical. And it was, I think what made it unusual was that it was live. And so you had this, you know, the FCC couldn't stop you. Mm-hmm. There was no 7-second delay. And so it really gave people an opportunity to express themselves without commercial intervention. Mm-hmm. I don't know that that type of show could exist today, but I think a version of it could, and that we really need this right now. I think that there needs to be a place where black excellence of every kind is allowed and welcome to flourish. Mm-hmm. I think that that's a part that could have been part of the demise of the show and that why there is such opposition toward it. But I think a cause is only as strong as the opposition that surrounds it. And so I would hope, I mean, hoping that our love letter to WNET and to the show will reinvigorate a dialogue around the show and perhaps creating a new model for it.
Public television was a big part, is a big part of the story. It's also a big part of the end of this story.
It is.
Because Soul was so controversial and interesting and had all kinds of people on it, it got in the crosshairs of conservative folks, even up to the point of Richard Nixon, which you have in the film. Ellis is a smart man. I want to play a clip. He understands that the funding may be pulled for the show or the show may be in jeopardy, and he calls for a writing campaign. So let's listen. I think the first voice is one of the producers on the show.
Ellis says, well, we better start a campaign. I said, what kind of a campaign?
We're trying to create programs of black love, of black strength, of black encouragement, and we hope that you agree with what's going down. And if you do agree, write us. If you don't agree, write us. We just need to hear from you. Our address is Seoul, 304 West 58th Street, New York City, 10019. We need your help. We need your support. We need your love. We need your disagreement. We just need to hear from you.
The letters started coming in. They were fantastic. Thousands of letters from all walks of life, all kinds of people. One guy said, "I'm not black, but that show has got it as far as I'm concerned." One young woman wrote in and said, "We have a big, expensive television set in the home, and it gets turned on twice a week for Seoul and for Seoul's rerun."
The campaign did not work. After 5 years, it lost its funding.
Which is in one way sad, and in one way just really indicative of what was happening at the time. Mm-hmm. And I think that, I don't think it was a failure. I just think that because things were changing in terms of broadcasting and in terms of the shifting political landscape, it really was more representative of the CPB and the various powers that be feeling like it wasn't necessary. What was necessary was the show, but what had caused the show to be necessary had changed. Mm-hmm. I think that was an important point that we made. And Gail Wald, who is one of our advisors and wrote this wonderful book, It's Been Beautiful, Ellis Seoul and the Birth of Black Power Television, she talks about that a lot in her book and how we have to recognize that there's a difference between what happens in terms of funding and what happens in terms of programming. I'm sure you know about that as well.
Sonia, last question for you. Sonia Sanchez says in the film that Ellis changed minds. Do you think he did?
I think he did. I think he was in the business of changing minds. And I think that he changed minds and he liberated minds. And I hope that that will be his everlasting legacy.
That was my conversation with writer and producer Melissa Hayslip about the documentary Mr. Seoul, which is screening virtually through September 24th. For tickets and more information, visit MrSoulMovie.com/screenings.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.